This week on Art in the Air, our entire show features musician, composer, recording engineer, producer, music publisher, whose stellar client roster includes hundreds of music placements on TV, David Kowal, whose newly released album, A Different Blue, includes a new single, Know Where I'm Going. Our spotlight is on Lassen's Resort and Museum steamboat rides, available this summer on Cedar Lake.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's Breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight. We've had her on before, Julie Sasada from the Lassen Resort. But we're going to talk about something special they have going on. She's the executive director of the Cedar Lake Historical Association. But we're bringing on two guests. They're going to have the new steamboat rides that are going around Cedar Lake. And we have Jerry Bino, who's the captain of the ship, and Ten Rita, who's the engineer. Welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Welcome. It's so exciting.
So, Julie, tell us a little bit about this. We had you on when we had your full interview before, briefly about it, because you're sort of like the cruise director, like Julie from the Love Boat, but now you'll be Julie from the Steamboat. So tell us a little bit about the general thing that's going on there.
So last summer, we had received grant funds to pilot this program. So we have steamboat rides on Cedar Lake, and we welcomed over 1,000 passengers in 5 days. So due to the success of that program, we partnered again with the Heston Steam Museum and asked them if they'd be willing to come back all summer for 1 day a week, each week, June, July, and August. So that is about to get going on June 2nd.
How many types of tours are there, Julie?
There are 4 different routes. So we have the Monon route, which takes you back and forth across the lake and shows you where the depot used to be. And then we have a northern resorts route, a southern resorts route, and our premium route, which does a little bit of all three.
And who tells the stories?
It's a combination of the captain, the engineer, and if we have extra staff on board.
Okay.
Ooh, can we get a story preview?
Well, I'll tell you, there's actually Cedar Lake has a rich heritage and culture around this lake, and the lake and ice actually built Cedar Lake both physically and with the economy of the lake, of the town and community, because, you know, this is a glacier formation lake. And then after, before refrigeration, they would actually harvest ice off the lake in the wintertime to use for refrigerated boxcars, keeping food fresh, your perishables. But really, the really cool thing is the story about the resorts and how the Lassen brothers innovated so that they had a way to get passengers across the lake, get them on board and charge them to be on board the boats to get them back to their property as fast as possible on their vacations. And that was that's how they thought of the Dewey Line. And it was a huge line of boats that the Lassens operated.
Did they have more than one boat then they were operating?
Yeah, we know for sure by 1903 they had 6 boats. They had Grandpa Dewey, Grandma Dewey, Mama Dewey, Papa Dewey, Steamer Dewey, which is the boat rise that we're recreating, and then Baby Dewey, which is a new boat in our fleet as well. So.
And how many boats do you have in your fleet?
We have 2. We have the Steamer Dewey, and then we have Baby Dewey, which is a little electric boat that is here at the museum all the time.
And how long are the tours?
They vary from 20 minutes to 45 minutes.
So not like Gilligan's Island where you have a 3-hour tour.
Not at all.
Do you have to book it ahead of time, or can you do it just as you arrive?
We prefer that you book ahead of time, so that way we know what kind of passenger manifest we have ahead of us. But people can hopefully possibly do walk-ups as well. But tickets are already on sale and have been live at lassensresort.org.
How many people per tour?
That varies as well. It's either 14 passengers on our longest ride, the 45-minute ride. Otherwise, it's 18.
Excellent. So, Captain, tell us a little about what you do on the thing besides obviously probably maneuvering the boat. So you're probably the steerman and the captain. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, steering and captain, yes. We're also watching out for our guest safety. So I make sure that the boat is in compliance with any local regulations. And we remind our guests about, the safe way to be on the boat and have a good time. And then just overall watching our timing. So we are on time with our 20-minute route or 35-minute route. And the wind conditions, weather conditions, just kind of taking the entire Cedar Lake environment and making decisions based on that for our guests.
What experience do you have as a captain in boating?
I've been driving boats for about 24 years, ever since I lived in Michigan. And I've had my license for about 5 years now. I am a charter captain in Chicago, Illinois. And so I drive out to Cedar Lake just because I love Cedar Lake and I love Julie and Ted. And I want to be part of what's going on here.
Very good.
Yeah, it's such a unique experience.
There's nothing like it. There are no other boats, passenger for hire steamboats in the state of Indiana. We are the only DNR licensed boat.
So the question for our engineer there, Ted, how is the boat powered? It's steam, but is it coal or what do you use for fuel?
So that's an interesting story because when we called the DNR who has jurisdiction on the lake, they said no steamboats. And we had to work with them. And so we had to come up with some compromises. So right now we power it with the fire is actually kerosene. And that heats the water and it makes steam and that's fed into the steam engine and that propels the propeller and that pushes the boat through the water.
Very good. Well, yeah, we have just about a minute left. Quickly, Julie, tell us some of the other things going on at the resort and then we'll make sure you give the website and everything and how to book passage on the steam line.
Well, every steamboat ride does include a museum tour with it. Complimentary standing admission. To see the museum. So people should be aware of that when they come to experience the boat, they're also going to be able to see the story of Cedar Lake and learn more about Cedar Lake's history. And then we have other special events going on all summer long, things like a community art show at the end of July, a speakeasy summer social in August, and a family train day in October. So there's lots to do, and they should stay in touch with us at lassensresort.org. That's LASSENS resort.org. And that's where they can purchase their tickets as well as find out all of our other special events.
Well, it sounds like lots of fun. We appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's in Cedar Lake, Lassen Resorts. That's Julie Sasadas, the executive director and tour guide, you might say, for that. We have Ted Rita, who's the engineer, and Jerry Vino, who's the captain. Thank you so much for sharing that on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And you've been listening to Abby's Theme. We would like to welcome David Kowal to Art on the Air. David was powerfully aware since 6 years old that he was drawn to music. He's fortunate that not only is it his passion, but also he parlayed it into a lifelong career. Early piano lessons happened, then bands, music college, jobs that enhanced his technical understanding and abilities. Then he went into business for himself. Moves to London and LA were also part of his journey. Currently, David is busy writing music for a variety of television production companies and just released a new album, A Different Blue, and a new single, Know Where I'm Going. David, Larry, and I want to thank you for joining us today on Art on the Air. Aloha.
Aloha, and you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, David, we always like to start off with kind of like your life journey. And I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about like where you grew up, where you went to school, just all about your whole personal biography and journey.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania in a town north of Pittsburgh called Lower Borough. And we had a very vibrant musical environment in my home. My dad and mom insisted that my older sisters at least play piano. So we had this little winter spinet piano, which I still have. I still write on it to this day. And I got fascinated with it around 6 or 7 years old. I saw them playing. I'm like, this is kind of cool. What is that? And started messing with the piano and all that kind of stuff. And eventually my parents said, well, you know what? He does really want to do that. So they got me lessons at eight or 9 years old. I started piano lessons. And I was mostly doing classical. I fell in love with music in the church. You know, my godmother was married to the organist in our church. And I had sort of visions of maybe I'll be like a classical organist. And I fell in love with Bach and doing all those fugues and whatnot. And I was around 11 or 12 or 13, and I heard Smokey Robinson's Tears of a Clown. And I kind of changed my career path. And then, of course, the Beatles hit, and all those things that happened in the era that I grew up in just changed my direction dramatically, and decided to get more into rock and jazz and blues and all that stuff. And my parents were so supportive. They, as long as my brother and I, my brother was 2 years younger than me, my brother Mike, and he played guitar. So we put a band together when we were like 12 years old, and just started playing and really kind of never looked back. We went through the whole process of pop songs and progressive rock songs. And then in high school, I had this amazing band director named James Lagoon, who absolutely was so supportive of what the kids were doing, so much so to the point that he taped us without us really knowing and sent the tape off to a competition. And we ended up winning the national championship in high school jazz band and got to tour Europe. And we got to tour Europe in this thing called the Anglo International Festival of Music in 1972, where we won first prize. We were the best high school jazz band in the world for like one day, you know.
So, David, were you playing keyboards or piano whole time?
Yeah, I was playing keyboards. I played, and that's what was great about Mr. Lagoon. He was so supportive of the electric part of it. I played an electric, I had a little Farfisa organ. So we would do like jazz arrangements of like Light My Fire by Woody Herman, but I would play the Doors organ part, right?
Oh, so, my gosh.
And then, you know, and I soloed a lot during the process. It culminated in us actually making an album. My first recording experience was in his studio in Pittsburgh called WRS Recording, no longer in business, but they had a really great 8-track system, Neumann board, you know, the whole bit. And so the high school band went in and played all our songs that we knew, and they actually put out an actual vinyl record of us. So it was really a very exciting time. And, you know, I played 3 nights a week all through high school, and it just made the high school journey a whole lot easier.
Faster.
And faster, yes. Much so now that I can't believe it was 50 years ago.
Yeah, I think in high school you always have to find your niche, and I think that's a lot of times. And once you find that, the school, it's like the classes become secondary. Everything else is important. So you're in school. Where do you go college-wise or career-wise after high school?
Well, after high school, we had a band together that was doing really, really well. We were opening for lots of different acts that came through Pittsburgh, and put together an original demo to send to record companies, and actually almost got signed to a major label. But at the last minute, the lead singer kind of decided he wanted to do other things and left the band. So one thing led to another, and my brother and I decided, you know what, why don't we just go to Berkeley in Boston and try to figure out where to go next from there.
So your band, was it originals, or what were you doing? Yeah, covers?
The band all through high, well, we did covers, and we also did originals.
Excellent. You know, so
we were pretty much progressive rock. We did things like King Crimson, Jethro Tull, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, you know, plus the Stones and Allman Brothers, you know, so we had a nice sort of eclectic mix of really kind of what was popular then in terms of blues rock and sort of progressive rock, you know. Then Berkeley was a whole eye-opener. I had a teacher named James Williams who went on to play with Art Blakey, and I learned so much from him and just really got more into what I was about, which ended up becoming, I really enjoyed the concept of possibly writing for film or television, and just taking, you know, the skill set that I had and applying it. And of course, this was the 70s, so by the time I journey to now, it's changed so much that it's not even recognizable, you know. Today you used to write with a pencil and paper, and now you just input it into a computer and hit print. You
know, so. I guess John Williams still composes with a pencil. He says,
"Oh yes, he does."
There's a quote, I think he said something about, "I'm just a guy who writes notes on a piece of paper," which, you know, obviously is an oversimplification of what John Williams does.
Well, yeah, I mean, most of those folks, they're on such a beautiful, wonderful, genius level, and all those characters that I met when I was in L.A., they are absolutely just the most humble people you ever meet, you know. I mean, it's funny, I was teaching this school, I was teaching middle school kids, and one of my students was John Williams' granddaughter.
Oh, okay.
Which was just this really, and she was a drummer. Barbara Gruska is her name, and she's a kick-ass drummer. She still is playing, I believe. So, yeah, it's, you know, one of those wonderful journeys that takes you through all different kind of places. I'm not quite sure if I've gotten off the beaten path here, but
oh no, that's we want to follow you down the path. One of the things we'd like to do is, of course, we want to sample some of your music. And "Nowhere I'm Going" is the first one. Tell us a little about that, and we'll take a listen to it.
Well, "Nowhere I'm Going" is the latest thing I've written. It's my most current single. I wrote it 3 years ago, and when you listen to it, the second verse has this reference to being in a small town, and I had no idea that when I moved to Peterborough, New Hampshire, when I look around, the second verse absolutely describes this town all the way around, and that's the only setup I'll give you for it. Other than that, it's kind of like the point of the song is sometimes you know where you're going, sometimes you don't. Life just does what it does, and just hang out and hang on and enjoy the ride.
Just follow along.
Follow along.
Well, let's take a listen. David Kowal, "Know Where I'm Going."
I'm so far from home, don't know when I'm coming back. So I sit here alone, I'm a old suitcase by the railroad track. Jump the first train, that's a fact. So I take a seat out back. A man comes by in an old green can. He says, "Where's your ticket, son? Is this the train you should be on? Do you know where you're going? Are you on the run?" But I say, "No. Two-lane town looks mighty. mighty fine when you've been living on city time. So I decide to stay a while, 'cause everyone around here smiles, and there's green for miles and miles. I say no, think of me with no regrets. Remember, I'm the one that said, if you know where you're going, you're already dead.
And that was David Kowal's Know Where I'm Going. Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, and that's one of your newer ones.
Yes, it is.
Brand new single.
Thanks. Yeah, it's available, you know, pretty much everywhere digitally, you know, as we say these days. And
all right, can we pick up your story, like after college then? What followed?
After college, so I got out of Berkeley, and disco hit in 1972. And so I was in Boston, and all the clubs that I played at and all the clubs that were hiring, they stopped hiring musicians. They put in, literally they put in disco balls. And if you wanted to play in a band, then you needed to play disco, you know. So I pitied the drummers then, because all they were doing was basically a slowed down polka beat, you know. I mean, they were just playing the same thing all the time. And I decided, you know what, I'm gonna fall back on some of that other skill sets that I got along the way and my love of tech. And a friend of mine who I'd gone to Berkeley with had gotten a job at Bose Corporation. So he called me up and said, hey, they're looking for some electronic techs. Why don't you just apply and see if you can get the job? So I did. I got the job, and I was working the production line at Bose. And loved it. Dr. Bose was an amazing person to work for. The company was really small at the time, and it was in Framingham, Massachusetts. So I was, you know, working at Bose and still doing music sort of now sort of on the side at night, and just kind of trying to figure out the next steps musically. But Bose was really my focus for 3 or 4 years. I eventually ended up in the engineering department, and I then ended up in the audiovisual department, where I became the recording engineer, which was the kind of thing that really kicked me back into, don't you really want to do this for real? You know, because they had the best equipment in the world, and we were recording single instrument demos from people like in the Boston Symphony would come in. So you get the most amazing, like, world-class player for an hour, and your job as an engineer is to figure out how to get the best sound with the best microphones, with the best, with Studer tape recorders and everything else. Like, not a problem. I enjoyed that gig a lot, you know. So yes, my job was to, you know, learn how to, you know, do that and put together demos and license music from other artists to put in our soundtracks, and then mix soundtracks and work for the audiovisual department and the marketing department, creating soundtracks for their slideshows and short films that they were doing about Bose. So did that for 4 years, and then around 79, 80, met another guy, my buddy Leo, and we decided to put together our own recording studio. And we both were at Bose. We both left Bose and put together our own studio, and they really just didn't look back from there. We did a lot of corporate work. One thing led to another. I eventually moved the studio into Boston, and he went more into different kinds of production, more video production. So in Boston, I was right in the center of it all during the 80s, had a 16-track, 2-inch recorder, a really great sound and drum room, and we did all kinds of corporate work during the day. And then at night, we would, like, you know, flip it over, and independent engineers would come in and just use the studio to record whoever they're recording. So we had a lot of really cool folks come through in the what was called the New Wave movement back then, back in the day. Ace of Hearts Records came in and used us a lot. A lot of independent bands, Rods and Cones, Down Avenue, a lot of different folks that really were part of that scene came in, and it was just a really kind of a magical time.
So during that time, David, were you also playing out?
I was. Around 87, I put together a band called Bridge, and we played every place there was to play in Boston, you know. I mean, this was back in the day, too, when if you were a local band, and there were two local stations, WBCN and Kiss FM, and both of them had DJs that had local programs. So literally, I could make a phone call on a Friday night an hour before where we were going to play a gig, and they'd put me on the air, and I could invite people to come down and see us, and then play a little bit of the song that was out, and then move on. And to have that kind of access was just wonderful, and I don't know that that happens anymore. It's kind of one of the things that was really, really great about that era. Everyone was just so supportive of trying to make something happen, you know. So that was a really, you know,
yeah, it was
fun
time. Different time. So yeah. We would like to listen to some more music, and can you tell us about our own little world?
Sure.
Our own little world.
Our Own Little World, there's an instrumental version of that on A Different Blue, the instrumental record that I put out before this, but this is the vocal version. I am the luckiest guy in the world because I married this wonderful woman named Barbara back in 1989, and we've been through all of it together. And this I wrote about 4 years ago, and literally it's just talking about like what it's like to be when you reach that kind of level of love and appreciation for what you've got. And it was literally just watching her sleep on the couch one night, and so the first verse came to me like that, and the rest of the song took off from there.
We're going to share Our Own Little World, David Kowal.
In the quiet night, I see your face, and those big blue eyes, every hair out of place. Now you're lying next to me, holding me so tenderly. I could drift off to sleep right there in your arms. This is all I need. Tell me your dreams. not like that innocent kind, but the kind that sings and cries and gives my spirit wings. So let me play for you. All the sounds that I hear, all the love that I fear, all the sweetest desires of wanting you here. 'Cause we're safe and sound in our own little world. 'Cause we're safe and sound in our own little world. This is all I need. So we hold on through the night, rest out from the fight, safe and sound.
And we're back. Our Own Little World, a very intimate song there.
Yeah, thank beautiful you. And so sweet.
Thanks.
Nice tribute.
You're listening to Art on the Air with our guest David Kowal on WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. So you've done a lot of like other like things for commercial type things. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, in Boston, I did a lot of commercial work, but a lot of what I would call, what they called then corporate work.
Right.
One of my biggest clients was Polaroid. Another one was Digital. And then companies that are no longer with us. Well, actually, both of those companies aren't with us anymore either. But Computer Vision was a big client. And those things always lead to other things, you know. So you do one project and then the next thing happens, you know. Fast forwarding a little bit, Polaroid Marketing, International Marketing, let's just take one project with them, which is Theme for America, one of the songs that I sent you. They wanted a song for their international science fair exhibit in Japan. And they wanted it to have an absolute Western feel, but they wanted it to also have Eastern musical elements. So I used the classic, thing. You know, like the pentatonic thing, and wrote this piece called Theme for America, where I go through five different changes, and they had five different applications for their photography. They had sports, they had medical, they had science and whatnot. I mean, most people don't realize that most of the images you see from NASA are Polaroid photography. They were huge in that field. So it was a very successful piece of music for them, and that's kind of how that came about.
So maybe we should listen to that before we continue.
Let's do it.
Okay, Theme for America. Let's take a listen and hear what we're talking about.
Thank you.
So that was Theme for America. Wow.
Fabulous.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things going on in there. It starts off really kind of, it's a full rhythm section. It's all, you know, this is 1985. So there, the only synthesizer is being played by me in real time. But there's no sequence stuff at all. It's all musicians playing. The string parts, you know, it sounds pretty huge and big, but that's just the quartet. So what we did is we had the quartet come in, and they were players from the Boston Pops, and I just recorded them four times with four different parts to give them a sense that I had a 16-piece section. And that's why it sounds the way it does, but it's really just four people. So, you know, you learn all these things in production on how to make things sound, you know. It's kind of like filmmaking and writing. It's like the willing suspension of disbelief sometimes, you know. So, but the drummer on that is Robbie Gonzalez. The bass player is Jimmy Earle. And both of those guys, Robbie played with Gato Barbieri for years. And Jimmy is currently the bass player in the Jimmy Kimmel Band.
Oh, okay, yeah. Night.
So, and he would play with Chick Corea for years. And so, you know, percussionist is Scott Bredman, who's played with everybody. And, you know, it came together, literally that whole track came together in an 8-hour period because it's a corporate, we need it today kind of production. So we started at 9 o'clock in the morning, finished at 6, mixed it by 8 and went home, you know. And I remember they were so happy with the track. I used to get fan mail from Japanese folks saying, wow, we really like your music, you know, and it's like, well, thank you, you know, where can we get it? I said, I don't know, you know, go to the exhibit again and watch it, you know.
But well, there's such a beauty to what you just described, you know, because now everything is, you can do everything via computer practically, you know, just.
Yeah.
What's nice about that, too, in the digital age, though people will complain about it in many ways, is that when you layer all those things for multi-track from the tape era, you know, you also increase the noise. In digital, you don't have that problem as much.
Right. You don't have that problem as much. The noise is probably the only disadvantage, you know, but I have this theory. You know, I was teaching middle school music in the early 2000s, and a lot of my students would say to me, how come the stuff from your era sounds so much better? Why does it move me so much better? Why is it? And it's like, well, sometimes it has to do with the fact that in a 24-track recorder, you've got 24 tracks. You don't have 180,000 tracks. So the lead singer, let's say the lead singer, has one, maybe two tracks to get their part. So if they don't like a part, they have to re-record it and destroy what was there.
Right.
So if you're not willing to go back, you can't go back. There's no going back. It's destructive recording, right? So two things would happen in those sessions. One, you have to punch in and punch out at the right time, because if you screw the punch out, if you don't go out of record at the right time, then you're going to lose what the lead singer already is very happy with, right? So it gave that urgency to all the performances that I think is what I think folks respond to, is the urgency of the music then, the passion of like, well, we better go for it because all we really got is like 15 minutes on the clock and one track. You know, whereas now, vocal tracks, it could get compiled by sometimes 80, 90 different takes.
Sure.
You know, which is wonderful, but also you can overanalyze stuff too, you know, so.
Well, and I was going to comment, one of the things, you know, you talk about people nowadays about how music sounds. And back in that era, you had a much more direct sound. You could go microphone, maybe through a mixer, very little processing to the tape. And then from once the tape is mixed to a pressing, where now everything is so processed. And that's really why I believe it doesn't sound the same. You know, and people talk about, you know, vinyl and, you know, of course, I think it's that direct analog sound that people like, because it has a much more direct sound. Of course, during that era, that was big for classical and jazz recordings, the direct-to-disc pressings, too. That was
kind of a
big deal.
Right, absolutely. And sometimes you heard the like Peter Frampton's live recording, which was like one of the biggest hits ever. That was a live recording, you know, or Jackson Browne's live recording, too, of his major songs. I mean, yes, you know, there's tremendous advantages to the technology today. I wouldn't go back for all the money in the world. But I think you just hit on it right there. The idea sometimes that things get overprocessed, I think, is just the accessibility of a project. Like I use Logic Audio on a Mac, and it's a $200 program. And with that $200 program, I get an entire symphony orchestra, 5,000 different sounds, and more processing than most people will ever even know how to use in a lifetime, right? All in a $200 package. So being able to know how to use all that, and just because it's there, people will use it, you have to kind of learn how to use it. So growing up the way I did and like using outboard equipment, like an actual outboard equalizer or an outboard limiter, you learn what the limitations are, what the thing can do and not do. When it's digital in the box, most of the time you might just hit the preset button. It's like, well, give me a, you know, precision bass sound from 1962. You hit the button and that's what you got. But is your player playing like they played in 19, you know, so you're absolutely right that sometimes there's so much overprocessing that they miss the joy and the beauty that's just sitting right there in the music. So really a big movement of moving away from processing and just letting it be more natural, which is good.
A little more raw.
Yeah.
You're listening to Art on the Air with our guest David Kowal on WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
So that sort of brings me to Riders on the Storm. How did you take a moody song and make it even moodier?
Well, Riders on the Storm, well, Michelle Schaefer, songwriting partner, called me up and said, so there's this brief I got, and there's some folks looking for a really moody, dark version of Riders on the Storm. I said, sign me up, because it's not that it's not a happy song to begin with. So, you know, we just decided to slow the tempo down and do what we did with it. So folks that have heard it said, well, you kind of nailed that pretty well. So we're really happy with the way it came out. And, you know, I rarely do covers, but when I get a chance to do one that's that much fun, it's just a real joy. So we had a lot of fun with it.
Well, we're going to take a listen to that because we're coming to the end of our interview, David, and this has been so, right, but tell us, first of all, how people can find your music, find your websites, all that type of thing, and how to contact you, and we'll wrap up our interview with playing Riders in the Storm, your version.
I appreciate that. I guess the easiest way to find me would be to just Google David Kowal Music, and you'll find my website and my Spotify and my iTunes links and stuff like that. They all kind of come up that way. That's probably the easiest way. Or you can just go to davidkowal.com, and it's KOWAL.com, and find me there. And I appreciate that.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air sharing. And, of course, we've had Michelle on the show also, so it's great to have you hook up with us. And we're going to listen out with David's version of Riders on the Storm. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air.
It's been David a complete Kowal. Pleasure. Thank you, David.
Oh, you're welcome. You have a great, great, great day.
Art on the Air continues with our guest David Kowal's music, Lazy Days. Thank you. Crazy Days from our guest David Kowal on Art on the Air. You've been listening to Art on the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president of radio operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art on the Air, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art on the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there. So don't just be an Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you this great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.